Things are moving quickly in cyberspace, and we ain't seen nothing yet, apparently. Mark Pesce is an author, a futurist, and an honorary associate in the Digital Cultures Program at the University of Sydney. He's speaking at technology conference Webstock 2010 this week. But he joins me from Sydney now. Hello, Mark. How are you?
Good morning, Kim. I'm fine.
Have you ever been spectacularly wrong about anything you predicted?
I would absolutely say that I have been. I'm racking my brains, but I would think it would not be beyond the pale to say that futurists missed the mark. I try to avoid the futurist mistake of saying in 20 years, because when you hear a futurist open their mouth and say in 20 years, you know that they're just going to be wrong.
So nothing takes 20 years anymore, though, does it?
No, everything takes 5 years.
It's like tomorrow.
Yeah.
What's the thing that excited you most, shall we say, in the last year?
Well, I mean, there's been a bunch of things that have been very exciting to me in the last year. I think that the most exciting one, which sort of came from nowhere, is this thing called augmented reality. Now, basically, what it means is we've gotten mobile phones, we've gotten mobile phones with GPS, and we've gotten mobile phones with GPS and cameras, and now we have mobile phones with GPS cameras and really fast links to the network. And what that means is that you can point your mobile phone at something. The phone will know where it is, and if it's got a compass in it, what it's pointed at, what direction it's pointed at, and it can then go out to the internet and grab all of this information about what it's pointed at and then feed that back to you.
Why do I feel queasy about this? One of the things you've said about augmented reality is that tourists will spend with their GPS camera, cell phone, mobile things. Tourists will spend as much time staring at their mobiles as they do ogling the sights.
Yeah, I think it's the same way.
Why don't they just stay home then?
Well, it's the same thing with tourists ogling their guidebooks. It really is going to be that kind of replacement.
Same. Why don't they just stay home then? Do you know what I mean? This is not augmented reality. This is substituted reality, isn't it?
I think there's something very comforting about the level of filtering that offers. I think you're absolutely right. And I think that the tourist uses that as a bit of a security blanket.
Yeah. Does it not worry you that instead of getting realer, we're getting more unreal?
Well, there's the argument goes in both ways simultaneously. There's an argument that we're becoming progressively more virtualized and separated. But I think there's another argument that what we're doing is we're peeling back a layer to see what's underneath. And I think this is the big promise of augmented reality, which is that it takes the real world and then loads it with all of the information that it has, but that's not immediately visible to us, and gives us more control over it as a result.
But we're not really equipped with, at this point in time, filtration systems that allow us to cope with all this stuff, are we?
I agree with you. I think it's the same thing that we found with the web. I was on the web very, very early on, so this is in 1993, and there was a master list of websites, and I'm not kidding you, there was just a list, you know, a couple hundred sites long, and I remember I went through it and I'd actually surfed the entire web
in
October 1993. And that list kept on getting longer and longer and longer. And then this other thing called Yahoo came along, which would break the list down into categories. And then this other thing called AltaVista came along, which sort of allowed you to search those categories. And then this other thing called Google came along. And so really, as the information pressure increased every step along the way, we developed a tool to help us deal with that pressure. And I think the same thing will happen as we start to, you know, produce all of this information in the real world.
It's more than that now. It's the social networks that are doing people's heads in a bit, aren't they?
Yes.
I mean, what's the demand for it? Why is there such a demand for Twitter?
Well, okay. I mean, we really have to step back. We are the social species. If you're going to separate any of the other characteristics that make us human beings, it is that we are social. From the moment we reach out, from the moment we come out of the womb, we are reaching out to make social connections. Now, first it's with mommy, and then with daddy, and then with the peers. And then it's the entire world, and we constantly engage in this stream of conversation and connection and reaching out.
With people we don't know.
Well,
that's not social. That's nuts. Huh?
I mean, I think that it's a way, it's...
Why do you want to share personal information with somebody you don't know? I don't get it. Help me out here.
Yeah, I think part of it is that what's happened is our social abilities have become amplified so quickly, so completely and so quickly. I mean, this happened over a period of 24 months, that it's taking time for our sensibility to catch up with it. And as it does, we rein things in and go, okay, well, wait, you know, I don't need to tell everyone this. I just want to tell everyone that.
Okay.
You know, I can see this with my Facebook. I'm looking at my Facebook and I have lots of people on Facebook. I'm like, I don't know you. How did you end up on my Facebook? And I try to sort of reason it out.
And you will never know them. I mean, it's not a preamble, is it? You're not going to get to know these people. They're just going to stay unknown people who are called your friends.
Well, I think it's an interesting mix because some of those people will swing into orbit, and that's a beautiful thing when that happens. that certainly happened on Twitter. You know, I now have a lot of friends particularly in Australia that I did not have before I started using Twitter quite regularly. And it's been really interesting watching these people swing into orbit and then maybe swing back out into orbit. So social media does offer that opportunity.
I suppose you think I'm just a Luddite, do you?
No, I think all of the concerns you're bringing up are absolutely valid and things that we need to remember as we rush headlong into this. The thing that we've done with social media is basically we've amplified our social capabilities, which are our innate part of us, the same way that the steam engine amplified our innate social capability, our innate power capabilities 200 years ago. The steam engine came around and it completely transformed the human environment. Cities are different, culture is different, civilization is different. The same thing's happening now because of social media.
Do you think that then we're going through a bit of an overenthusiastic stage and that eventually we'll, you know, things like, I don't know, maybe even Twitter will die away and we'll start picking and choosing, or will the surge carry on so that every day there's something new, some new way of communication that we don't even need?
Well, I think it's going to be actually a bit of both, because what's going to happen is right now we have these great big generic social networks. So Friendster just is, you know, there's your friends, bam. Twitter, there's your contacts, bam. And they're just sort of these great, big, undifferentiated, amoeba-like masses. What you really want is a network, for example, as I grow older, I'm going to want a network of my peers so that we can all sort of keep an eye on each other as we age gracefully or ungracefully, and so that we can actually do some of that work of supporting ourselves, because the health system's not going to be able to do it. There's going to be too many old people running around. So I think we're going to see...
Well, not going to be running, are they? They won't need the health system.
Right. So we're going to develop sort of highly customized social networks. I think we're going to see industry segments develop highly customized social segments. Academics will be developing highly customized social segments, so that rather than being these big, blunt, generic tools, we're going to have finely crafted tools because we've come to understand them more.
Doesn't that defeat the purpose of the web and the internet, in that it's supposed to bring people together in some kind of jolly Gaia society, but it's going to split itself up and become just as fragmented and just as atomized as the society that it was supposed to overcome?
Yeah, again, the web is an amplifier, and so I think it amplifies in both directions. It amplifies in the sense that it can aggregate vast numbers of people, but it can also amplify in the sense that it can get you down to the 10 people who believe exactly what you believe about global warming.
Books.
Mm.
What's going to happen?
Well, this is an interesting thing. I actually started writing my Webstock talk, thinking I was going to write one particular thing about ebooks and how amazing they are and all this. And as I sat down to write, I realized it was a much more complicated subject than I thought. So, of course, we have now Apple's iPad and we have the Amazon Kindle, but we have the Apple iPad.
Have you got the Kindle? Is the Kindle in Australia yet?
It is. I don't particularly care for it, so I don't have one.
Why don't you care for it?
It feels clumsy.
Yeah, is the iPad better?
Well, I haven't had my fingers on an iPad yet, so I can't tell you. All right, and I refuse
it's quite
to actually.
Big. I mean, it's book sized.
It's book sized. I refuse to render an opinion until I've actually had my fingers on it. But there's something's going on there. On the other hand, I do have something called Stanza, which is a little application for my iPhone, and it is a beautiful ebook reader for my iPhone. And so I pop books on there, and it's small, but it does a really nice job rendering it and making it feel like you're.
So, are
there
books
book.
That you would prefer to read in the paper form, and books that you would choose to read on a machine?
Well, certainly lots of textbooks are much better read on the machine than they are in paper form.
Now, because why?
Well, because it's easier to search them. All right, because a lot of nonfiction or technical material you need to be able to search and to bookmark really easily. And so I think that ebooks are going to be an enormous win for students and academics.
What do you mean? You don't have to read the whole damn thing. Is that what you're saying?
Well, it's not just that. If you need a particular topic in there, you can go type, 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 bam, and you're right there.
Okay.
So you may have read the whole thing, but then when you're using it as a reference text, you can get to any particular point really easily.
Well, as opposed to just looking at the index.
Yeah, which is long and clumsy and inaccurate, maybe.
Okay.
So, I mean, it is an improvement over the index. It's also an improvement just because you don't have to find the book on your bookshelf. It's all right there. So there's a sense of immediacy around that. But I also see the fact that, essentially, once we've got all these books stuffed into cyberspace like that, they all start to sort of dissolve around the edges because, you know, there's only a specific class of books that have this requirement for long linear narratives, and most of them are fiction. Most of them are sort of novels and things like that. When you get to this large sea of nonfiction texts, they start to dissolve somewhat. They start to get interconnected one with another. And I think that the place where the book/ebook is evolving is that place where all of this nonfiction stuff has sort of melted down into something that's a fair bit different than we think of when we think of a book today.
Can you explain that a bit more? What do you mean melted down?
Well, you know, no book is an island. Every book implicitly references other books. And we know this because we use the web every day. Before the web, we weren't really aware of how interconnected all of knowledge is. And now we use the web every day and we don't think about it. Well, books are the same way, but books have never been explicitly interconnected because they've been static, they've been printed, they've been books. Now they're really going to be able to amplify that quality of interconnection. And so whether you need to read 100 pages or whether you just need to read 300 words and then go to the next 300 words, which might be in another book, or the next 300 words, which might be in another book, I think it's going to be some combination of those two. And every time we sort of tend away from this long linear form into this shorter bite-sized form, we're changing our expectations for what the book is going to bring us.
One of the other issues that you've talked about is live streaming. Which is, I suppose, the logical extension of Facebook and Twitter, is it?
Yeah.
It'll become the norm.
I guess it is. You know, Gordon Bell is one of the researchers who was originally at Digital Equipment and now at Microsoft, has really been pioneering this idea that you can have wear device, which he does, which just basically captures continuous audio and video of everything around you. And you can then dump it into the computer and it will annotate and, you know, this is who you were hanging out when, blah, 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 blah. And so you basically have this complete record of your life that's being created. Now,
no matter how boring your life is.
Well, maybe that's an encouragement to spice things up.
Narcissism gone mad.
I don't know if it's narcissism. I think that particularly for people who lead very busy lives or people who have poor memories, this could actually be a really, really useful thing.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So who did I see yesterday and what did I have for breakfast?
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the whole argument about the signal-to-noise level. You don't necessarily want the entire world to know, or the entire world will not necessarily care what you had for breakfast. But if you're having an interesting conversation with interesting people, in fact, the world may be interested by that.
Of course, but the interesting people will never do this. Am I presuming that the interesting people are too interesting to want to put every moment of their lives up for observation?
Well, I think they may do it for themselves. Whether or not they choose to share it, I think you're right, is another question altogether. But I think there is going to be a value in doing it for yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. There's also something wrong with that, though. It's like everything's unedited again. Again.
Yes.
You know, everything. And okay, you might say, well, tomorrow or the next day, we'll start the filtration system going. But There's too little editing going on.
Yes, you're right. And your memory is very good at doing that editing.
Exactly.
Yes.
That's why we have memory, so that we can forget some things.
Yes, absolutely. Huh. Absolutely. And I would assume that the persistence of these sort of live streaming systems is, again, going to start to blur memories the same way that the ebook is starting to blur what the book is.
Is technology... I don't know whether this is a sensible question or not. Is technology always anticipatory now? I mean, for example, did phone companies know how texting would take off among the young?
No, in fact, that's an extremely well-known phenomenon. The SMS was introduced and no one knew that anyone would use it really for anything. And of course, now we send I don't know how many trillion messages a year, but it's pretty outrageous. So in fact, most of that is not anticipatory.
So in the end, things aren't being foisted upon us. We are still adapting things and making use of things in our own way.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you there's a lot of examples of failed technologies because they tried to force a technology onto a market, particularly before the market wasn't ready for it. Now, I mean, I'm in some sense a classic definition of this in that in 1993 and 1994, I invented a 3D interface to the World Wide Web. This is really right after the web had been invented. And, you know, we got companies behind it. We did it all sort of free, what we call open source today, so that anyone could join in and do it. Mm-hmm. And we put it out there, and there was what they call the classic hype curve, where, you know, it got into big magazines and people were talking about it was going to be the next big thing, and then it just sort of died. And the reason is probably because there was only so much novelty that the average person could absorb in a period of time, and frankly, the web was more than enough. The 2D web was more than enough. So just now, 15 years later, we're actually starting to get to the point where all of this 3D is starting to be integrated with the web.
Gosh, you must have become impatient in the meantime.
Well, I got very philosophical.
I was just thinking, I was talking to Robert Connolly earlier about East Timor and the Balibo Five, the five young journalists who were killed over there in 1975 by the Indonesians, and who, had they had cell phones, had they had satellite, had they had, you know, direct broadcast, would have not died, actually. And I'm wondering, carrying on from that.
Well, okay, I mean, let me just challenge you there, because, you know, it hasn't stopped people from dying in Iran. And I mean, but the interesting thing is we know what's going on in Iran right now because it gets captured on mobile phones and then it gets smuggled out across the internet and out to the BBC or to whatever.
That's true. I mean, I suppose I was making the assumption that the Indonesians killed these five journalists on the assumption that nobody would ever know what had happened to them, so they made up a story. Whereas if there had been cell phones, you know, all it would have taken was one just to flick on his video camera on a cell phone and away. Anyway, do you think that in years to come, 5 years, okay, we will look back and say that this kind of technology, the kind of instantaneous sharing technology, has changed the world for the good in terms of democracy, in terms of bearing witness, in terms of calling the bad people to account?
That's a good question. I mean, I think it already has. This is the thing. I think that even now you can see that in a situation like Iran or in a situation like China, that the governmental organizations are forced to contend with this force, which they never had to before. Now, they're becoming good at thwarting it. What we really have is a sort of cat and mouse or an arms race around these technologies, because as the block gets put up by the technology, the government finds a way to sort of alter itself. So just this week, Iran announced that they were going to block Gmail, so Google's mail system, so that they could introduce their own Iranian mail system that everyone could use, and presumably so that the Iranian government can read everyone's email, because Gmail was in part presumably being used as an organizational tool. So we're going to have this little dance, and this dance is proof of the fact that it's having an effect.
A couple of decades ago, we were told we'd be telecommuting and working from home. And instead, we seem to be spending more time at work. Are we still waiting for that to happen, or is that, you know, never going to happen?
No. Well, I mean, the interesting thing is that the thing that we realized once we could telecommute was how important the social space of the office was. You know, and that space for connection and for community is actually really important, and that if you send someone home, they may start to feel very isolated. and not perform well. Now, the thing that we've got that we didn't have was flexibility. So that if you're a new mom, or if you're staying home with a sick kid, or you need to work at home one day a week for some other reason, that's become really easy to do now. But in terms of permanent telecommuting, again, it seems that the whole sort of structure, the human structure of the office, wants to have that kind of contact.
I've just been talking to Nick Bollinger about music, and he's a big fan of vinyl, which is, you know, 3 steps away from where most people are, if not 4. And he's a big fan of albums. What do you do about that? Have you've presumably got an iPod, and you presumably have your own tracks on it.
Yes, yeah.
Which are not, do you put entire albums on it or just choose the tracks you like?
No, I tend to put entire albums on.
Do you?
iPod, yeah.
Because Nick and I were lamenting the fact that more and more people are just cherry picking from the album, when in fact some tracks need to be listened to a bit more than the cherries that are picked, and then they grow and so on and so forth. So it's going to change the way albums are made, it's going to change the way people make music, it's going to weigh, you know, everything, and not necessarily for the best.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Well, I mean, again, this is another side of that whole, I mean, we're moving to a more discreet media culture where, you know, there's this phenomenon called TLDR. TLDR is an acronym for too long didn't read. And, you know, if you come across, and all of us do this when someone gives us a link and we hit a page and we're staring at 3,000 words. And at that point, we're faced with, are we going to make a commitment? Are we ready to make a commitment? And so we found that the sort of the average TLDR limit for a human being is somewhere around 300 words. If you give someone a link to something that's about 300 words, they'll probably invest themselves. More than that, you're making a request. And the same thing is being asked for, I think, with an album or with a track of music or with a video, anything like this. We're now starting to see that because there's competition, where, you know, back when it was all album-oriented rock in the 70s, there wasn't competition.
No.
You know, there was pop music, 3-minute songs, and then there were albums, which were masterworks. And now we actually have this enormously competitive environment for our attention. So the album has to contend with all of these other choices.
And so, you still put albums on your iPod.
I do. But then I'm a dinosaur. I hail back from the era of album-oriented rock.
Mm. But in the end, albums won't exist anymore because they're TLDR.
Well, I mean, I think musicians still want to be able to do long-form works. And I think that to the degree that they want to do them, there'll be a space for them. Now, whether that means they're going to be million sellers, we're already sort of leaving the era of the mega hits behind. And it may very well be that if an artist does an album that's, long continuous work, that he's going to satisfy himself or she's going to satisfy herself that it's going to be 10 to 50,000 copies rather than 100 to 500,000.
Are you worried about any development of technology?
Well, okay, yes.
I'm giving you the opportunity now to be less gung-ho about everything.
Well, I don't. The funny thing is, I don't even see myself gung-ho. I try to see both sides of the issue. It was interesting. I do a TV show here in Australia called The New Inventors. And before we did a broadcast, this is, I think, the first series that I was on, the host was sort of poking a bit of fun at me for being a futurist. And he just points at me and says, Mark, predict something. And I said to the audience, well, you'll all be using your mobile phones about 10 times more in 5 years. And I heard an audible gasp. And this was 4 years ago. I heard an audible gasp out of the audience. And you know what? I was right. All right, because you have everyone in every public place now, everyone is leaning over their iPhone or their BlackBerry or whatever it might
be. But this is the weird thing, Mark. I mean, I know this, I've got a cartoon in my head because we're constantly told, as we started out this interview saying, we're social beasts, right? But more and more, we're gathered together in social situations, ignoring each other completely because we're too busy texting somebody entirely different.
Right, which is another kind of social communication. And they're now contending with each other. And I see this accelerating attachment to the device right now, and it's happening really rapidly, and it's happening really comprehensively. It's funny because Apple, you know, has all these little applications you could get for the iPhone, and every time a new one comes out, the device gets more alluring. It gets more alluring to more people, and we get more attached to it, and that process seems to be accelerating. Same thing will happen with the iPad. That process is accelerating, so these devices are getting more and more alluring, and in a sense, And I'm not sure how imprecise my language is. In a sense, we're becoming fundamentally addicted to them.
And that worries you?
Well, I don't know where that's going. And for a futurist to say, I don't know where that's going, that's something.
We'll end on that honest point. It's nice to talk to you. Look forward to seeing you in New Zealand. Mark Pesce, who's speaking at a technology conference called Webstock 2010 this coming week.